I just wanted to state, like, none of these questions, like, I said, other people have told me. I'm just a messenger.
Right. They'll protest too much.
The first question is, what exactly is the concept of Das Torah?
Okay. The first place, technically the first place it's mentioned is in a Gemara, but it means something very different in the Gemara than it's popularly meant. The first place that it appears in its modern context is Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. And it's been used and maligned a lot, and people don't really understand what it means, what it doesn't mean. I would like to try to explain it. How are you? Shalom Aleichem. I recognize a familiar face. Our Silver Spring representative. What? You're from Silver Spring.
Yeah.
I know. you're from down the block. No, you're a neighbor. See? That's a story for you. Let's give a hypothetical case. Somebody, thank you very much. Somebody wants to open up a club where boys and girls will meet on a university setting. The things that will go on are not going to be halachically appropriate. They're going to be wrong. But it'll save people from getting intermarried. It's a question. So is it better? Is it worse? How do we deal with a question like that? So one opinion was, well, if you feel like doing it, do it, open it up. You mean L'shem Shemayim, and it's good. Does the Torah have anything to say about it? Well, the problem is there are no direct halachas in many life situations. You really, really can't find a clear sefer shahara. And sometimes you can when you work out a halachic tshuva, and sometimes you can't. So what do you do? So does it mean that Torah has no opinion about it? It's going to be clear that this is a major issue. On the one hand, you have a question of people being assimilated. On the other hand, you have a question of people doing things that are wrong. Are you allowed to do it, be a dayim or not? Should you do it? Is it important to do it or not? You have a shul. You open it up for people that will drive in on Shabbos. You'll bring them close, Yiddishkeit, but you're making a statement that driving is okay. Now, sometimes you can find the halacha for it. Sometimes you can use halachic tools and, you know, be madame milsa milsa. A lot of times you need to have an instinctive response. And the question is, whose instinct? Our instincts are developed by our personalities. Who we are, what we do, what we live. Somebody who lives a Torahical life, we assume that his feelings are going to be a lot more in line with what the Torah would want. And therefore, you would ask it to somebody that you feel is a person who's steeped in Torah. He's somebody that this is his life, this is what he cares, this is his world. And then you'll say that the value that he espouses is probably what the Torah would like. I'll give you an example in something else. Let's say in medicine. There are things you can test for. You go to the doctor, you say, you have a, I don't know, it hurts on this side, that side, the other side. He sends you off a battery of tests. Sometimes the tests tell you what the answer is. And that's there. You know, the x-ray shows this, the MRI shows this, the blood test shows this. You don't need a doctor for that. That's fine. The doctor maybe just has to figure out which test to order. Sometimes it's inconclusive. And you need to get a sense, is it going to be, should we think about appendix and operate? Should we think about gallbladder? Should we think about this, that, or the other thing? And then you ask somebody who has a lot of experience, well, this is his life, that he's hands-on, and you figure that his answers will probably be the closest to what's right. So the correct definition of Das Torah would be the Das of a person whose identity is, whose being is identified with the Torah. It's a combination of the amount of knowledge, it's a combination of the depth of his commitment, it's a combination of his integrity. And you figure by going with his instinct, you're going to do what the Torah would like you to do. That would be, I think, the It does not mean, and this is a very tricky point. Does the Das Torah have to know whether a coalition, the government, will work or not? The answer is no. But the Das Torah should be answering, is it appropriate to be in a coalition with people whose declared and avowed principles are very anti-Torah? The answer might be yes, the answer might be no. But still, at the end of the day, if you really want to do what Hashem wants instead of what you want, you need to ask the person that's closest to it. Good, okay, yes. That's exactly, it's people that when they learn, they really want to know what's the Ruach of the Torah, what is it? And that's a type of, that's Das Torah, that's what it is.
The second question is, what is Judaism's view of Gehenna? Like, what is an accurate
interpretation? Okay, let me quote first a Rambam. Let me quote two Rambams. And the Rambams are, on the face of it, kind of are coming from very different angles. The Rambam is in the introduction to, its introduction to Sanhedrin, where he speaks about the fundamentals of Amunah, is one Rambam. The other Rambam is the Mor Nevuchim. The Rambam, when he speaks about the fundamentals of Emunah, he brings down, people ask about Gan Eden, the topography of Gan Eden, the trees, the water, the forest, the this, the that. And he said those type of questions indicate that the person doesn't begin to understand. He's clueless. He said, you're struck out before you started. On the other hand, he raises the question in Mor Nevuchim, since people are, every single Jew, the youngest, the least smart, the furthest out, has to believe in a God that has no body, that's totally incorporeal, why does the Torah use words that might mislead a person? God's hand, God's this, God's that. Why does the Torah, yes, use those phrases? Now, half of the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim is built on explaining, chas v'shalom, to take those phrases literally, God is not a goof, and so on. So the Rambam says that if the Torah were to use, it doesn't say in as many words philosophical phrases, but if the Torah were not to use that, people would think of it as not being real. They would think of it as being an idea. You know, I don't know if, how many of you are familiar with the famous Dear Virginia letter in the New York Times. It was a letter written at the turn of the century, not this one, last one, and I don't remember it personally, but it was, I remember reading it. This was, it's a little girl had written into the New York Times, who knows everything. She's heard from some people that Santa Claus doesn't exist. It's really shaken her emunah. Is it true or is it not true? So they wrote it back, a letter, Dear Virginia, of course Santa exists in the heart of every good person. You know, there's a Santa, and goodness is Santa, and only even wicked people say there's no Santa, and so on. A whole letter like that, which basically means he does not exist, but we think of it as an idea, so on and so forth. It's written very, very well. You know, they do write well, and it's kind of cute. But the bottom point is, of course, it's nonsense. But you know, but it's good to tell kids about it, and it's an important myth to keep going. The Rambam says that's what it would look like. So, Gehenna is a real place. A person's neshama has tzar, tremendous tzar. But if imagine Mashkiach would have to say a shmuz, if you do this and this, Your neshama is going to have a very special ruchnistic tzar that you can't even imagine. So it wouldn't be a great deterrent. But it is going to hurt. It is painful. So you say, you know, physically it's painful to burn your hand. If someone catches you stealing and they have your picture on all the newspapers, it's embarrassing, it's painful. Well, think along those lines. It is painful. It is a tzar. It's a tzar that's mezach the neshama and so on. But as a person gets more mature, he needs to understand it more and more in a ruchnistic sense. Just like when you mature, you realize that embarrassment can sometimes hurt a lot more than some physical pain, and people will undergo some physical duress not to be embarrassed. There's a tsar of the neshama, and that's a tremendous tsar. But I mean, the Mesil Sharm puts it in a very interesting way. He says, look around you in your life. Think of the situations when people beat you, everybody did better on a test than you, everybody did better than this, everybody's invited out, you're not invited out. Think of those cases. And don't tell me that it doesn't bother you when in Gan Eden you're going to be an also bid. Yes, they'll shoo you in. Imagine somebody calls you up and says, you know, I really wasn't thinking of inviting you, but everybody else is coming, I can't let you sit home alone. That's a painful invitation. It's almost, it requires a lot of achzarius to give such an invitation. Well, imagine, you know, you get the call and say, listen, you don't deserve to go to Gan Eden, but, you know, call yourself Yashrekhom Haba, so here, shoo in and tag along with the rest of it. Imagine eternally sitting in the back, kind of. Again, it's a mushel, but it's a mushel to something very real. And that's why you need to balance the two. You need to understand it in terms, take it away from physical, but to keep in mind the pain of it when a person is suffering. Okay?
I mean, the question more of like the person asked me, when want to know like, what exactly is it like? Like, I think, you know, as you know, all of us here are bombarded by secular culture, trying to think like, how is our view of the underworld, so to speak,
let's take a look. As you grow and mature, and you know, not looking, you know, drawing yourself away from thinking that movies are the picture of the world, and understanding that movies are you know, there's no reality in it. Forget about everything else. I'm not even going with the sense of a Gehenna. Most people that, God forbid, commit suicide, do it for reasons of mental anguish and emotional anguish, not physical anguish. A person, you know, people who, this person lost all his money. So what? He can get a job and live lower middle class, you know, but I can't. I was the great millionaire. Everybody hung around me, this and that. You know, those, you'll still have what to eat. You'll have what to eat. You'll have an apartment. You have this, but I can't face it. Imagine an eternity where everything you've done wrong is exposed, and every shekel that you build up is torn away. It's a very painful process. Well, we need to be sensitive. If we're not sensitive people, and honor doesn't mean anything to us, then it's hard to imagine the pain of not having honor. And that's why, to imagine Gehenna appropriately, you have to have a more spiritual sensitivity of right and wrong, and the shame of doing something wrong, the shame of cutting a corner, of cheating on somebody, of kind of not being nice to somebody, of, you know, taking a step, you know, ahead of the game with that you didn't deserve. When you have that sensitivity, you have a much better picture of what Gehenna is. And that's why it's a hard one. You don't want to go, you're mature, you're growing up, you should need to make the transition to understanding it more in ruchnistic terms than in physical terms.
Third question is, what exactly is the Jewish view on beards? Like, the person who asked me to quote that, they said the Zohar apparently requires every yid to have a beard.
And I'm looking around the room and trying to figure out who was it that asked that question.
And
I see stubble. What?
And also some the laws of, you know, clean shaven, and like, you know, either there, you know, you're supposed to take out some gears from the shaver if you do shave.
Okay. So the answer has two or three parts to it. And again, in the letter of the law, in the letter halacha, you're not allowed to be mashkes paskamcha. There are certain hairs in the body that you can't be mashkes. The definition of ashkos, the place is, there are five locations on the head. It's sort of five pretty much extreme pieces of the beard. That's a shomarach, and you can look it up for yourself. And hashchasa is defined as a very close shave. Halachically, it's there are different ways of testing it. Different rabbanim have given different guidelines. In Eretz Yisrael, it tend to be machmir a lot more. In America, many of the shavers, the rabbanim have masked them that it's okay, it leaves enough hair because a razor really cuts very close. It has no guard against it. And the old-time shavers, at least, would have a guard so that you were never cutting directly the hair of the beard. You know, you weren't cutting it close to the skin because there's always a piece guard. and the reason they, you know, no, they don't want to end up with an electric blade scarring your face. So there always had to be a guard, and that pretty much kept it. You never were able to get the close shave of a razor with a shaver. They've become smarter since then, and they have, and they've come up with different things that can have the same result. For instance, it'll tug the hair in, cut it so that basically the skin will never get past the guard, but the hair itself gets in as close and so on and so forth. So in America, they have different lists of shavers that are kosher, not kosher. I personally don't use a shaver now, in the last 40 years or so. So, you know, I mean, since I've been married, so it's not, I can't tell you exact models and makes. But in America, different kosher organizations do have lists of it and so on and so forth. And that's to show that they hold a bigger share and so forth. That's the dry halacha. The spirit of the Torah is that a beard is a tiferes to the person. It's a beauty to the person. And like we spoke before, Das Torah deals with more the Ruach HaDvarim. The Ruach HaDvarim is that a beard is a more appropriate form of appearance than without a beard. It's not Asur, it's not Mutter. But there's a wide range of activities that are appropriate, less appropriate. And then you have to weigh the different things. Are you going to that? A person who works in a business environment and being clean shaven is very important. We definitely would tell him to be clean shaven. If a person doesn't have that obligation, but he's so enamored with the Western culture that he thinks clean shaven is nicer, he's missing something in the Ruach HaTorah. But in our perspective, it's a question of, again, the spirit of it rather than the letter of the law. What about the Zohar? Now, different in halacha, everybody has to pretty much agree. There aren't, you know, everyone has the same shulchan aruch. There's machlokas, but the parameters are the same. But the whole package of Torah comes together with the spirit. And for instance, if you ask a question, is it better to daven a little bit later with kavana or a little bit earlier with less kavana? Is it better to go to the mikveh first and daven later, or not? This is a little shasat chak. That's a little shasat chak. So there is room for real distinctions. And, Chassidim built a whole Avodas Hashem, that davening is the most important thing. And if a kid came to Seder and didn't come to davening, they would toss him out of Seder and say, how dare you sit and learn God's Torah when you haven't davened yet Shachar, so you didn't daven a minyan, or you missed it, you came late. And it was considered to be an appropriate way. In a Litvish approach, it was sit down and learn, and at least you'll have learned something today, and you know, take care of Shachris, you know, it's still within the Zman or whatever it is, but there were different valid approaches, how to structure what would bring to what, and what's important, and what's less important, and so on. Every group has the things they're more makbid on, and every group has things they're less makbid on, because you can't pull a blank in every direction. As somebody once said, if you take all the appropriate things to do, it's important to daven vasikin. It's important to get up before davening and learn. It says you shouldn't sleep in the morning. It says that if you're up at night to learn, you know that's the kisra shel Torah. To get up tikkachatzai is appropriate, and it's tremendous things. If you take all the things together, there's no time left to sleep. So at the end of the day, you need to say, okay, I'm not going to be a tikkachatzai person. I'll be the kisra shel Torah person, or I'm going to do tikkun chatzos and I want to vasik, or whatever it is. A person's got to make some choices. Chassidim were makpid a lot on what it says in the Zohar and in Kabbalah, and made it part of their lifestyle. The Zohar, what it says in the Zohar, is not obligate you, but it's an appropriate understanding, an extraordinary appropriate understanding of life and a bigger picture of Torah life. So a beard is mentioned. The kedusha of a beard is mentioned in the Zohar a lot. A lot is spoken about it, and therefore, in Chabad especially, it's more relevant in Chabad because they interface with more modern. The other Chassidim don't interface, but Chabad does. Wearing a beard is yahar vayavar. It's like very, very important. It's another way of structuring Avodas Hashem in an appropriate way. In other places, they'll say, first thing, let me sit and learn. In Litvish yeshivas, when I remember, they didn't let you grow a beard because they felt every frumah thing is the Yetzirah's big thing is not to learn. Learning is the hardest thing to do. It strikes a person in his most important place. It's in his head. And that's why if a boy starts pashing with things other than learning, it's an excuse. That was the approach of the literature world. And that was the derech I was mechunech on. Sit down and learn. Don't worry about not Afghanis, not a beard, not this, not that. Sit and learn. Everything else is Yetzirah. It was an approach. It has its tremendous milus. It has its shortcomings. And there was an approach of like a Chabad, where a beard is Kedusha, and that comes very early on. So it's the answer is, halachically, it's not obligatory. It is within the Ruach HaTorah, and how much it should be stressed depends on the big picture of Avodas Hashem. That's the...
It's really like the person. It's like, I don't, if somebody's a God-fearing person, go up to Shimon, I don't think I should be like, "Do you wear a beard?"
Well, somebody, I once heard a very good Vark. There was in old Yerushalayim of 150 years ago, there was a poor shoemaker, a semi-literate shoemaker, who was sitting and listening to an Ein Yaakov shir, which is Agadah. And the Rav said the Gemara that when you come in Shemayim, they're going to ask you, Tzipisa b'merkava, did you learn Kabbalah and see the heavenly Merkava? So he was scared out of his wits. He's coming, he's getting older, and he's going to come to Shemayim. They may ask him, and he's dead. I mean, well, pardon the pun, yeah, he is dead. So he came to Rabbi Shua Leib, and he said, "I'm terribly disturbed. I just learned the Gemara, I'm going to come to Shemayim, and they may ask me if I learned Kabbalah. What are we going to do?" So he sort of patted on the back and says, "Don't worry, my kin," he says. "They know who to ask which question." He says, "That's not the question I have in store for you. I guarantee you. If a person follows a derech that's been paved by big people, by a tzibur that's chashuv, every one of those drachim will get you to the right place. And priorities are different. Within the halachic parameter, there's room for different priorities.
Next question is...
I see that people think a lot over here. It's not a question yet.
In today's day and age, a lot of the Gedolei Hadar, they learn, but they're not exactly in the workforce. Yet you have Rashi, the winemaker, the Rambam, was a doctor. I know this from over the summer. I learned a little Kalsimtalar, Simkalum Shishka, was a pharmacist. So I was thinking, why exactly in today's day and age did it come to be like, you don't need to work, you just need to learn all day? Like, why can't you do curriculum?
Well, let me flip the question around. Many years ago, they had pharmacists who was a Rabbeinu Pshischa, doctors who was a Rambam, and winemakers who was a Rashi. Where are all those winemakers, all those pharmacists, all those doctors? So what happened to them? Let's discuss it, and let's talk a little bit about it. First of all, just to clear up, Rashi being a winemaker is not all that clear. The Rambam being a doctor is very fascinating. I mean, everyone picks the biographies they like. The Rambam's first major, the most of his life, he was a kol person supported by his brother. He had a brother who supported him. There's a letter from him to his brother. His brother then drowned. He wasn't with a ship, with merchandise, he drowned. And the Rambam couldn't get over his tsar. First of all, he loved his brother. And he said his brother had supported him. It's a letter of the Rambam, and so on and so forth. When he became a doctor, his amount of time he could learn, there's a letter from him. And again, you can get the Igros of the Rambam, of Shilat put it out, very, very well done. And he writes, he had given over his Moreh Nevuchim for translation to Ibn Tibbon. And Ibn Tibbon wrote him with a whole bunch of questions. It's a major, Moreh Nevuchim is a very delicate work. You're dealing with a translation. And the Rambam writes his schedule, and he says, "I don't have time to breathe during the day because of all the patients I have to see and so on and so forth. I don't have the time to give you." So obviously, when the Rambam was a doctor, he could not have been, it did not coincide. The two kufas in life did not seem to coincide based on these two letters. Rashi being a winemaker, we have no idea. The real issue is, certainly, it's the preferred mode of doing things. The problem is, if a doctor has to spend 12 years doing medical school, where 99% of the day is taken up with studies that he needs to do, you wouldn't want to go to a doctor that had spent his years of training doing other things. In today's world, the Rambam sets up the ideal as working 3 hours a day for parnassa and spending the rest of the time learning. That doesn't exist today anymore. except unless there are people who do it, there are people who are very good business people, they've inherited a business, they can have the business run on sort of autopilot and be misasik. Ashrei betolam. It's really good. It has a lot of milas. And it means that you're not beholden to people. But the reality of that being true today, it's almost impossible. Look, a normal doctor, 12 years, you can't learn more. An hour a day is a luxury to learn when you're training. And when you're working as a doctor, most doctors work 10, 12 hours a day, and they still are barely ahead of the game. They're always complaining. I live in a town with lawyers. They're coming home 9, 10 o'clock at night. So the question is, show me the reality of being able to do the amount of learning. And I think in a certain sense, it used to be, society used to be people grew their own food, made their own clothing. They were very self-sufficient because the level of economy was kind of very simple. Today, we split it up. And one person, sews buttons on a shirt. And one person bakes bread. And one person puts the crust on top of the bread. And that's the way society has become. It's almost impossible to develop a person that can have both. So Baruch Hashem, we can hope for Bnei Torah, people who are in the workforce and are Torah people. Their values are Torah. They set time aside for learning. And that's a very, it's a davar chashuv ad moed. But if you want people to be chashuv in learning, it's really, really different. I always wondered, yes, you want to ask one? I was thinking, someone asked me, why about Rabbanim being more well-rounded, learning more things, and so on and so forth. They appreciate this, Rabbis learned this, that. And a lot of times it comes at the expense of Torah. Very rarely, occasionally you get a person who's brilliant and really knows a lot. So imagine you had a problem with your heart, Chas v'Shalom, and you go to a cardiologist. And you ask somebody for a recommendation, I'd like a cardiologist. And the guy says, Dr. So-and-so. He's fantastic. Because, he's not one of these narrow people that just focuses on cardiology. He goes to the opera once a week. He reads up on the latest things. He's into sports. He's also done a side field on, middle-age history and this and that and the other thing. And you say, he sounds like a fantastic man. Maybe I could have him for dinner one week, but you have another cardiologist. You're asking a Rav Shaila. So if the person is a serious Talmud Chacham, you would expect him to put a big part of his life and focus into learning. It's Ravina Mizrachan Rav was the Rav in Silver Spring. He came there as a young man of 26 from Telz. He was brilliant. He was a guy in Ireland. Very, very smart, very sharp. He had not gone to college. The town, Washington, consisted of scientists. There was a scientist shul. There's still Dr. Spetner. Admeir Vesem still lives in Rehovot. He's a wonderful person. He was one of the founders. And, he came, he spoke, he made a very, very good impression. And then someone asked him, by the way, Rabbi, what's your college education? He said, I don't have any. He says, this is a scientist's stool. He asked, how many people in the room have a doctorate? And about a third of the people raised their hands. And how many have a master's? And almost everybody raised their hand. And how many have at least a bachelor's? Everybody. He said, you're not missing any scientists, but there's not one Talmud Chacham in the room here. He said, why is it that you're demanding of me, you need somebody who can pass the shaylas, learn with you, teach, and so on. It is important. I'm not knocking. It's important in today's day and age when you meet anyone who does plan to go out to Chinuch, to Rabbanus, needs to have an acquaintance with the ideas that we've shown them. We're well acquainted with the science, the ideas of their age and time and age. It's not something unimportant, but you need to realign it. And it's not, I can't think of any profession today that a person would do it seriously that would allow him to grow to be a Talmud Chacham. The only parnassas would be a business type of thing where you have a set business and your involvement is kind of set and so on. But other than that, it's just the...
So it's understandable that when learning Gemara, you need a kis and beer, but yes. Which one exactly is the ikar? It's a machlokas.
It's a machlokas in the Gemara. So let me answer a question like this. There are two stages in your learning. One stage is when you're climbing up the mountain. In other words, you're coming from not knowing how to learn to knowing how to learn. which means getting skills, basic skills, getting more mature, sophisticated skills of, you know, thinking about what you've learned, getting vocabulary, and getting some basic elementary bank of ideas. That's very hard to say which is more important, because they're both important. And, you know, Rav Gifter used to said once, today's age, people know more and more about less and less, until they'll know everything about nothing. You know, so it's important to know a lot, and important to have skills. Reading skills, learning skills, thinking skills. What's a kasha, what's not a kasha, so on. When a person has sort of gotten to the plateau where he's got the skills, so on, it depends on a person's tchumas nefesh. Some people are cut out for really taking part of sugya, saying very good yisodos, you know, good kashas, and eon type material. Some people are good at memorizing a tremendous amount, getting things down. At the point where a person passes the level of being a talmid chacham to some degree, it depends on your nature, and a person should follow what he does, and so on and so forth.
So next question: what consists of
Minhag
HaMakom, and when does it apply?
Okay, it is a perek in Pesachim, Makom Shenoagu. Yeah, anybody who really wants to know what Minhag HaMakom should learn it. The devil is in applying it. It used to be that a town had a set bezdin, a set marat asra, and however he would paskin would be the pesach for the town. So if he paskin, for instance, like Rabbi Yosef paskin that basa b'cholov is mutta, it was mutta in that town. And towns were very independent, and each psak and each bezdin had its own, you know, that was it. Today, two things changed. First of all, we have cities, like a city like New York has 1,000 communities, you know, battering each other. Most people belong to no real community. Most people just stop where it's convenient to stop. They don't feel allegiance to any particular community. How do you deal with that? And also, if the person who's the rav in the town is not a talmid chacham, I was once thinking about Reb Chaim Kanievsky online, and the person in front of me asked Reb Chaim Kanievsky. Reb Chaim Kanievsky is very blunt and very laconic. But, you know, his answers are sharp and sometimes quite blunt. And this person asked him, you know, if the Rav of my town, it sounded like it was a hick town someplace, said something, is it, you know, does the town have to go by it? And he said, if the Rav is a Talmud Chacham, yes, if it's not, or it's not. You know, so the question is, if a person comes to a place where the Minhag HaMakom is built, where the Rav is not a Talmud Chacham in any sense of the word, it's not just different opinions, is that binding? The answer would be no. You know, what about things that are not halacha? The Minhag HaMakom is that they throw the candies they throw for a chassan are raisins and almonds. Is that Minhag HaMakom? Minhag HaMakom has to be something with a halachic basis for it, either a halachic basis or a takana. It has to make sense from a Torah point of view, that there's a reason why you're doing it, and it has to be established by Talmid Chacham, and it has to be universal. This town is one community, one rav, and this is what they do over here. There are other reasons. A lot of the Gemara, it's not clear in the sugya, but one of the bases for Minhag HaMakom is the sinner that it generates. In other words, when people do things differently than are normally done in town, people don't like it. They get upset. So generally speaking, it is appropriate when you come to a town to do what people do. In other words, if people are davening in a certain way, even if it's not halacha, you know, not to rock the boat. If it is a community and it has a certain way of doing things, it's appropriate not to try to rock the boat. But binding is only the three conditions I told you. It has to be a halachic minhag. It has to have some shaychus with halacha. It has to have been established by somebody who's a talmid chacham and it has a halachic basis for it. And that there's one community and a clearly defined community. Which Yerushalayim is, for those of you who haven't guessed it yet, Yerushalayim is a crazy quilt of communities, unfortunately. Even though there's many Yerushalayim is just, you know, just tons of communities. It's
just last week we had a speech about kashrus, you know, there's a bunch of different hechsherim, you know, it's not focused.
Well, see, that's, for instance, hechsherim is not Minhag HaMakom, really, as much as it's, first of all, realistically speaking, the kashrus, the quality of the kashrus is different. You know, if somebody tells you what's the difference, what car you bought, a car is a car, you would laugh at him. I mean, it's an issue with kashrus. If the crowd that somebody is servicing doesn't care about kashrus, then how well do you think that kashrus is? When you want to check up on kashrus, who's the crowd that they're trying to service? If it's a crowd that couldn't care less, and just as long as it says kosher, so how much do you really think the person will care? And it's also, people have to understand, it's very difficult to, running a kosher thing is difficult because there's a tug of war between the people selling the stuff and the mashgichim and the rabbanim. The people selling the stuff think that the mashgichim are a pain in the neck. You know, he's always getting my way, he's always telling me to do this, to that, the other thing. It's not as simple as it appears on paper. There's a constant tug of war. You know, he needs more lettuce, and the mashgiach is taking forever to check the lettuce. So what do you think he's going to do if he's not a from person? I mean, I'll tell you the truth. Personally, I don't feel comfortable eating in a place that the owner, I don't think, is Yirei Shemayim, even if he has a good hechshah, because it's a constant battle. There was a story in Washington, in a town which happens to have a good kashrus. This is about 3/4 of a year ago. One of the bachurim in yeshiva was a mashgiach in the JCC. And he's a very shrewd bachur. He's actually a very good mashgiach. And he's always wary of them trying to pull a fast one over him. So they told him, oh, we need you to go check lettuce in that other room. We need more lettuce. He said to himself, they don't need more lettuce. Something strange. He went to the other room, and he snuck back, and he saw the guy bring in a dozen Safeway steaks because they had run out of steaks, and they didn't want to wait for a kosher delivery, and Safeway is much cheaper. So they had sent him off to check lettuce, and he went to buy, and they bought same steaks. They closed the place down on the spot. But if he wouldn't have been shrewd enough, if he would have been couldn't care less type of person, this would go on. The owner was not even Jewish, but he was under Ashkacha, and it's a constant battle. It's not as easy as you think it is. People, you know, it's not the owner's interest. It's the owner's interest to have a note that says kasha. It's not his interest to keep having the guy nudge him. A goy is not supposed to, you're supposed to wait for the Jew to come and put the stove on. So what do you do if the mashgiach calls in and says, I'm going to be late an hour? This person serves breakfast at 6 in the morning. It's a breakfast takeout place. And there's no omelets and no hot cereal. What do you think he's going to do? He'll find a way to light the stove. You know, he'll find a way and he'll excuse himself and he'll apologize and curse. But, you know, it's not as simple as you think it is.
Is anything really these days?
No.
The next question is, I don't know how many people here know about this. What do we say to a conservative or a foreign Jew who brings up the Gemara of Torah lo bat v'shamayim?
Okay. I would answer sharply, it's also not the Shol Tachtis. But, you know, that would be they wouldn't know what Shol Tachtis means, and I see. Torah lo b'shamayim means that when people pasken it according to halacha, they sit, they know that dan lamita shel Torah, any psak is good. When the psak is not lamita shel Torah, it's not, you can ask him back again. This is one of the points about conservative reform issues. In order to define yourself, you need to have something that's inviolate. Let's ask ourselves, where do we draw the line? How do you approach the difference between us and reform / conservative? To define yourself, if I have a club, my club is the Democratic Party. I have a Democratic Party. So someone will come and ask me, well, what does Democratic Party stand for? So let's say answer, we take a look around and see what people want to hear, and that's what we stand for. So that's another way of saying we don't stand for anything. It's like, what shape is protoplasm? Whatever shape you want. It doesn't have a shape. So what does it mean, the religion that can become whatever you want? It's anti-Zionist, pro-Zionist, semi-pro-Zionist, depending on what's current. And if the answers, so if they can't answer that, then it don't exist. You're telling me you are what people want you to be, so you're not a religion, you're a kind of PR agency, you're a service agency. It's like you're a restaurant. You don't, you know, it's not a shita of any sort, it's not ideal. If the answer is we're about goodness and kindness, that's a good one. It puts us in the same club as Christians, as Buddhists, as most people, as atheists. So if you ask him to define yourself, the word fine is a line. Infinite means it has no boundaries. Define yourself. What is inviolate? And if they have no answers, they don't exist. And if they have it, so what do you mean, Loba Shemayim? If the Bible is what you want it to be, then for all practical purposes, it doesn't exist. The Torah says that gay relations are usher. If that became mutter, so who says stealing is usher? I have to think stealing is mutter. Who said adultery is usher? People think it's wrong. Okay, so don't tell me the Torah said. Tell me the congregations think that it's wrong. But there's no, by definition, religion is coming down with a definition and saying this is it. But if it's whatever you mean it to be, whatever you want it to mean, halacha, even heter, the common halacha, are always within the framework of halacha. And you do 101 contortions to fit. An eruv is an eruv. And an eruv, you know, it doesn't avoid the halacha, it keeps the halacha. It's the hardest mesechta's eruvin, because you need to keep those details. You know, you can use your chacham within the details, but you need to keep them. And I think you can put the person on the spot and say, well, tell me how you define yourself. And if the term is something vague that fits everybody, then you haven't defined yourself. What you're telling me is a wonderful definition. It fits any decent human being. You're honest, upright, caring, sensitive, socially aware, intelligent, seeking, searching. Fine. That defines anybody who has a Torah Sodom. You know, it's why call it Judaism? You know, it's I think Christianity stands for these things. You know, and the.
How about Islam?
What? They have other ideals. It's a.
They got style.
Oh, they got style.
Last question.
Last question. How do we in today's day and age, especially with the Muslim movement obviously not being the same one as when it's inception? How do we balance godless ha'adam and shiftless ha'adam?
Okay, I guess for should I explain what those where you're coming from? Okay, let's go back a step or two. You took into account the longer answer when you said the last question, right? Okay. The Musa movement was one of the movements that came into Klal Yisrael as a reaction to what they felt, like Hasidim, was too much focus on the details of the law and not enough on the spirit of the law. Hasidim had their way of dealing with it, with the singing, the dancing, the slavas. Musa tried to do it through introspection and thinking a lot about the self. Rabbi Saul Salanter was the one who established it. It's mid-1800s. And in the Litvish world, that was similar to Hasidim. There were a few trends in Musa. One was the Vardik, which focused on ripping self to shreds. The basic message was, you're full of it. You know, that's you don't really mean it. It's a game, and you're suspect. That was, and I think all of us can apply it to us. Without embarrassment, we can feel it's a lot of it. And they worked very hard at doing things to break yourself in that way. The other extreme, there were many, was Slabodka, that said to people, "You are the prince. Is that the way you should be acting? I mean, how does a prince act?" There was a joke, an anecdote type of joke, that there were three Musa movements. There was a middle of the road called Kelm, and they described it as follows. The Vardik said, if the world is wearing a tie, we will discard it. Kelm said, if everybody wears a tie, wear a tie as well. And Slabodka said, who should be wearing the tie if not for us? So that was the godless Adam approach. Now, the truth is, down deep, so every one of those movements had its advantages, but it's disadvantage also. Sometimes a person does better when he rips himself up, when he sort of peels away a lot of the built-up nonsense and haughtiness and conceit and so on. And sometimes a person needs to live up to a higher image of himself. You know, you take a kid, a bar mitzvah kid, and you dress him in a nice suit and so on, and he's not playing in the mud anymore because he feels grown up. So for us, that we're not part of any particular movement, the answer is, and that's why it's important to have a Rebbe, to guide you personally. For some people, Rav Volba writes, let me give you an anecdote in Yeshiva. This is a personal anecdote, not Rav Volba. If you don't have a Rebbe, you take your natural personal problems and multiply them. There was a fellow in the Mir, learned together with me, a very wonderful boy. His problem was, he was as slow and as deliberate as molasses. He pondered everything, agonized everything. He even spoke slowly, and it was difficult. And it was across the board, a wonderful person, a masmid, a bentora, a gentle person, but he was slow, indecisive, and so on. He sat in Rav Chaim Shlomitz's shmuz. Rav Chaim had a shmuz. It was called Nefesh Mibahalot. That's the title of it. He said it over many times. And it was about how terrible a midah impulsiveness is. And when people do things impulsively and just, you know, off the top of their heads, they always mess up. And he would finish it. Rav Chaim had a little snippet from the Shinus, Nefesh Mibahalot. That we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu should save our nefesh from behilus. Behilus means this person I'm talking about came over to a mutual friend after the shmuz. Said Gedalia. He said, I'm not going to take the time to give the time that he took. He basically said, Reb Chaim Shmuz opened his eyes to how terribly impulsive he is, and how off the hat he goes. And he's mekabel on himself to do things much more deliberately, but a lot more thought and a lot more thing. I assume somebody set him straight because the guy is married and so on. But if you don't, you know, for a person like that, it's poison. You have people that are naturally depressed, and when they start thinking about that you're nobody and you're full of it, it's a one-way ticket down. You have people that are naturally conceited and naturally full of it. And they think, I'm chashev, I have to keep myself chashev, and so on. Both of them are important tools. A connection with a Rebbe is invaluable, simply so that someone can tell you, you know, the work that you need done in yourself, this is a much better way to go at it. This is a much better way to go at it. So both of those movements gave us tools that are important for development, but nothing beats a personal connection to a Rebbe. And I want to say something about the setting like here and the setting. One of the problems in America today is Yeshiva University is a huge place. And what happens is a huge place can give you a lot of things, but you lose out on a Rebbe relationship unless you make it your business to have one. When you go through a year like this in Yeshivas and Eretz Yisrael, I'm always jealous for many reasons. In Atzolik Yeshivas, they have a lot more Rebbeim per student than they can have in America, at least not financially. In Eretz Yisrael, it's much easier to have many Rebbeim than it is in America. People don't realize a yeshiva and personal growth has a lot to do with having Keshu to Rebbe. I know some of the Rebbeim here, and it's a wonderful group. You're zocha to have people that are, you know, that are people you look up to and people that you can relate to. I would tell you to keep that kesher, and wherever life takes in the next stages, there are very, very special people in Yeshiva University. Make it your business to hook on to somebody. Find yourself a Rebbe, somebody that, it needs two things. You need to be able to look up to the person, and you need to be able to, and he needs to be able to understand where you're coming from. It's he needs to have ideals that you can grow into, and he needs to be able to understand where you are and what's the right thing for you. There is no amount of sfarim and no amount of self-thinking will produce it, because whatever crookedness we have within us stays unless somebody taps on the shoulder and says, you know, you're going the wrong direction. This is not where you should be going. So I guess it's as a good note to leave off on is the difference between a yeshiva and a university/college/institution is a Rebbe. Learn to have a kesher with the Rebbe. Use that kesher, keep that kesher, and whatever environment you are, you know, in Mitzvah Shem, when you grow up, you get married, and you have a family. When you move to community, one of the things you look on is the Rav in the community, somebody that I look up to, and that will help me move. When you're married and you're established, you don't stop growing. You grow more slowly, but you still need that environment. It's probably the most important thing you can get it in this year, and it's the most important thing to have in the years to come.
Okay, thank you very much.